Thank you. So thank you for the opportunity to give a talk here. So I'm going to talk about self-correcting quantum memory. So this is going to be kind of an overview of what has been done in the last 15 years along those lines. So there's going to be a few of my results in there, but also many results from other people that have contributed to this field. So this is work I started doing my PhD at the University of Sherbrooke, and then I'm continuing at the Institute for Quantum Information and Matter in Caltech. Okay, so the goal of the talk is to try to address whether or not we can find a self-correcting memory. Okay, so that's a fancy word just to say a hard drive. We want to have a quantum hard drive where we can put and store quantum information. So that self-correcting memory is going to be some physical system, and we're going to encode some quantum information inside it. So there's a few desiderata. We would like this encoding to be reliable. We would like it to long for a long period of time. And we're going to let the memory interact with an environment. And that's going to be usually a thermal environment that's going to introduce some noise, but also to put some limit on the amount of energy that can be put to the system. So the template you should have in mind is the following. So initially, we're going to encode by preparing some quantum state. And after that initial step, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to let the quantum system interact with its environment, introducing some noise, so some errors, but also shedding the energy available in the system. And then after a long period of time, we're going to get some quantum state. And at that point, we might do one step of decoding to actually get some state at the end. And we want this encoding to be reliable in the sense that this final state should be as close as possible to the initial encoded state. Okay. And so just to be very clear, we're not talking about active error correction. So I'm not in the paradigm where I'm going to allow myself to do measurement on a very short time scale, try to diagnose the error, and apply a correction. I'm not allowing myself to do anything during that storage time. And so throughout the talk, I'm going to talk about code. And so very generally, the code is going to be some subspace of the Hilbert space of dimension of these two, where I'm going to encode my quantum information. Okay, so suppose I want to encode a qubit, I'm going to have some subspace of dimension two where I prepare my qubit. And typically, this subspace is going to be the degenerate ground space of a local Hamiltonian on qubits on a 2D or 3D lattice. Okay, so this is the typical scenario I'm going to look at. And the question is whether or not I can find a suitable system to build my quantum hard drive. So before going to the quantum case, let's look at the classical case. So at least to a theorist, a good approximation to classical hard drive is a 2D ferromagnetic Ising model. So this is Hamiltonian of this form, where you have a sigma z interaction between nearest neighbor. And if you look at the ground space, it's going to be spanned by the all up state, that's going to be logical zero, and the all down state, that's going to be logical one. Okay? So if you want to encode some classical bit, what you're going to do is to either initially prepare that ground state or that ground state. And now we're going to put that into contact with the thermal environment, that's going to put some energy into the system. Some of the spins are going to flip. And what can be shown about the system is that it is thermally stable. As long as you're under some threshold temperature, you're going to just to have some spins flipping here and there, but there won't be a macroscopic error droplet. So just by looking at the magnetization of the system, you can easily tell if you started from the all up state or the all down state and then recover your classical bit. So this is very different from what happens in the 1D case. In the 1D case, if you were to look at the same thing, Ising model, but on a chain, so you would have spins on a chain, then you would, again, get the twofold degeneracy, the all up state, the all down state. But what happens if you put that into contact with a thermal environment, one spin is going to flip, let's say the spin at the end of the chain flips, that's going to create an excitation, which is this domain wall, because two spins are now anti-aligned. And then the second one could flip, and again, there's only one domain wall, so the energy has not changed, and that domain wall would just go back and forth inside the chain, and would totally erase the information I had about the initial ground state I prepared, okay? So in the 1D case, it would be thermally unstable. So in 2D, I'm thermally stable, and now I can imagine, well, let's use the superposition principle. I could encode a quantum bit by just preparing an arbitrary superposition of the up state and the down state. So that doesn't work because this model is not stable under perturbation. So if you put a small magnetic field, this, let's say a field that points up, it's going to favor one ground state compared to the other, and then you're going to get dephasing at the level of your encoded qubit. you're going to favor one compared to the other. And more generally, this is going to be true for any system that has a local order parameter, because the environment can couple to the local order parameter and then favor one ground state compared to the other. So we don't want that to happen. So we would like to have a quantum system which has a degenerate ground space so that we can encode quantum information. And because of the reason I just told you, we don't want to allow for any local order parameter, because there we would get some kind of dephasing because of that. And so put another way, we'd like to have a spectrum which is stable against local perturbation. So typically, I'm going to look at gap systems. So there's going to be some degenerate ground space. There's going to be first excited state. And there's going to be a gap, a constant gap between the two. And when I say that I want a stable spectrum, is that if I do put the local perturbation, I don't want the gap to close. And I don't want the degeneracy of the ground space to be lifted. Okay. So those two conditions define what I mean by a stable spectrum. So what candidates do we have for such quantum system? Well, this is going to be topologically ordered system. So those are going to be our primary candidates for building a quantum hard drive.
So when you say yes, you don't want the degeneracy to be lifted.
We allow something exponentially small in system size. But that's at most what we're willing to tolerate. So the canonical example of a topological system is the Skytteria story code. So you have a 2D lattice, 2D square lattice. You're going to have qubit sitting on the edges of this lattice. So that's each of those white dots. And you're going to have an L by L square lattice with periodic boundary conditions, meaning that this qubit is actually the one right here. And same thing on the other direction. And that defines a torus, hence the name toric. So we're going to define a local Hamiltonian, which has two family of terms. Terms AS is going to be the star operators. For each point on the lattice, you're going to look at the four neighboring qubits and put a four-body Pauli X interaction. So X tensor X tensor X tensor X, okay? So that's one family. So you're going to have one such star operator for each vertex on the lattice. And similarly, you're going to define plaquette operators. So for each plaquette, you look at the four neighboring qubits, and you put a sigma z interaction, so sigma z tensor sigma z tensor sigma z tensor sigma z. And now you're going to look at the Hamiltonian, which is minus the sum of all star operators and all plaquette operators. An important thing to realize about this Hamiltonian is that it has very nice properties. In particular, it has commuting local terms. So if you look at star operators, the commute among themselves is just sigma z operators. Same thing for the plaquette operators. So the interesting case is when you have a star operator and plaquette operators, if they're far apart, they do not overlap, they do not talk to each other, they trivially commute. And if they're close to one another, they're going to overlap on two sites. So there's going to be one anti-commutation here, a second anti-commutation. So minus one times minus one gives plus one. So globally, they're going to commute with one another. Okay. So now we can play with the Hamiltonian. You can see that on a torus, it has a four-fold degenerate ground space. You can ask yourself what happens if you do put a local perturbation. You can show that it's actually spectrally stable in the sense I just told you about. And now the question becomes, is it thermally stable? Okay, what happens if I do prepare a ground state and put that into contact with a thermal environment? So let's do that. Let's prepare a ground state that's going to be a plus one eigenstate of each of the star and plaquette operators. And now I'm going to put that into contact with a thermal environment and see what happens. Okay. So at the end of the day, what I want is to be able to recover the initial ground state that I prepared to recover my quantum information. So I'm going to be particularly interested in the structure of logical operators. Those are operators that commute with the global Hamiltonian. And we're going to look at a subset of them that act non-trivially inside the ground space. Okay, so they're going to have action. They're going to be to map one ground state to a ground state. And they act non-trivially in the sense that they're going, for instance, to map a ground state or an orthogonal ground state. So in the case of the toric code, such a logical operator is going to be a chain of Pauli Zs that wraps around the torus. Okay? So for instance, this thing is going to map some ground state to orthogonal ground states. So if the thermal environment manages to apply this logical operator on my quantum system, it's going to take me from one original encoded ground state to a different ground state. So when I'm going to come back later to retrieve the information, I'm going to get some logical error because I won't be able to retrieve the initially encoded ground state. So I don't want to, my thermal environment to be able to do that. So again, it's a thermal environment, so it can only generate so much energy and put so much energy into the system. So I'm going to look at the energy of excitation using this energy meter. So initially, I start from a ground state at energy zero. This green part is going to be constant energy. And this red part is going to be an energy that scales with system size. Okay, so a thermal environment can only put a constant amount of energy into my system and cannot create excitation that would cause something that scales system size. So what can my environment do? It could apply a Pauli Z error here that's going to entangle with the star operator here, flipping the plus one eigenvalue to minus one. Same thing for the other star operator on the right. So now I have some energy in my system, some constant amount of energy due to those two star operators not being satisfied. Okay, so there's going to be some amount of energy in my system, a small constant amount. And now the environment could apply another Pauli Z error here that's going to, again, concatenate with a star operator, flipping it to the minus one sign. But if you look at the star operator in the middle, it concatenates on the left and concatenates on the right. So globally, it commutes with the error. Okay. So in this whole procedure, I didn't change the amount of energy present in the system. However, I kind of extended my string of error. So I can keep doing that. And eventually, I will apply the full Pauli Z string that wraps around the torus. And my environment will have applied a logical error. Another way to look at it is in terms of a quasi-particle, you've initially created two quasi-particles with the original Z error. And now I showed you that you can move one particle one step further away from the original particle. And that doesn't cost any amount of energy. And so those quasi-particles are going to move around, eventually wrap around the torus, come back to the vacuum, to a ground state. And then I've gone from one ground state to a different ground state. So my thermal environment, by putting a very little amount of energy into my system, manages to take me from one ground state to a different ground state. Okay? And if it does that, there's no way for me to recover the initial encoded information. So again, if you think of it, as this picture is going to come back often in the talk, so this is the support of the logical operator in purple. So it's a non-trivial string around the torus. And what I've just shown here is that in the case of the toric code, thermal fluctuation can accumulate and corrupt the initially encoded information. Okay, so this is not a thermally stable system. So now I'm going to try to tell you something about self-correction. So I'd better give you a definition of self-correction. So self-correction is related to the problem of equilibration and thermalization, which is a complicated problem. There's actually a workshop going on at PI at the moment about that. And so usually you're going to be able to make precise statements by looking at a precise system and looking at the dynamics. That's not what we want to do here. So we would like to make a very general statement that's applicable to a large class of system. So we're going to keep a very simplified model for thermalization. There's going to be two things in that model. So first, we're going to penalize higher energy state to mimic the Boltzmann's factor. So we're not going to allow the environment to put too much energy into the system. And second, we're only going to allow local transformation in the noise model. Okay? So essentially, local CPTP maps. And that's justified by the fact that the environment interacts locally with the quantum system. So it should only be able to create those type of errors. So if we come back to the template I showed at the beginning, you encode by preparing some ground state, and then you let the thermal environment interact with the system and introduce some noise. And afterwards, you're going to do one step of decoding to retrieve the information. So something that would be terrible is the thing I presented in the case of the Turing code, is that if the environment is capable of finding a sequence of local transformation, changing the ground state, then you've lost the initial encoded information. So in this model, the question becomes, is it possible for the environment to find a sequence of local transformation changing ground state without spending too much energy, without putting too much energy in the system, because it's not allowed to put too much energy in the system? So suppose there exists such a sequence of local transformation that takes you from one ground state to a different orthogonal ground state. That's going to create a sequence of intermediate state that are going to have some energy above the ground space energy. And the question we're going to be interested in is, what's the maximum amount of energy that the environment needs to spend to be able to change the initial encoded ground state? Okay? And that thing we're going to call an energy bar. And now the question becomes, is this energy bar something small, constant, independent of system size, like in the case of the toric code, in which case we have a thermally unstable system, or is it something large, scaling with system size, in which case we can scale up the system until we're happy and we have something that the thermal environment, there's so much energy to overcome for the thermal environment that it cannot in practice apply this logical error. Okay, so yeah, that's the image you should have in mind. You have one ground state, an orthogonal ground state, the energy barrier. If you have a thermally unstable system, you have an energy barrier which is small, independent of system size, like in the case of the toric code. Whereas for a self-correcting system, you have a macroscopic energy barrier that scales with system size. So you can just, by scaling up the system, increase this energy barrier. And at some point, it becomes, in practice, almost impossible for the environment to take you from that ground state to a different ground state. And that was the case of the Ising model in 3D. Okay? So the rest of the talk is going to be devoted to this question. Can we somehow combine the thermal stability of the Ising model with the spectral stability of the toric code? Okay? Is there a way to combine those two properties and then we would get something self-correcting? And we're going to look at this question in 2D, 3D, and maybe higher dimension. Okay, so unfortunately, we're going to see that in 2D this is not possible and we have no good result of increasingly larger applicability. So if we come back to the example of the toric code, the reason for the thermal instability was essentially twofold. There were two key features. First is that the logical operator was supported on a 1D string of particle, okay, which is already peculiar for a 2D system. So that was the purple non-contractible string around the torus. And furthermore, the logical operator was a tensor product of single body unitaries. Okay, it was just a tensor product of sigma x. So it's clear how the thermal environment can apply it through a sequence of local transformation. It just applies sigma x on one side and then sigma x on the other side and so on. Okay. So this is true for the toric code. Let's go to stabilizer codes. Okay, maybe we can address the question whether or not this is some generic feature or it's actually just peculiar to the toric code. So I guess most of you know stabilizer code. They're widely used in quantum information. They're defined by a generating set of commuting stabilizers. And a ground state, or a code word, is going to be a plus one eigenstate of each of those stabilizers. So either you think of it in that way, or you think of it in terms of Hamiltonian, you're going to have minus the sum of all the stabilizer generators. So you define a ground state that way. Now you have a proper definition for the ground space and for first level for excitations. And now you want to know whether you can find one which is thermally stable. And a general result for 2D stabilizer code is that you won't find one. Most precisely, you can show that there always exists a logical operator, which is string-like, meaning it's supported on a 1D string of 1D strip of particle. So this strip could have some width in general, but it's 1D, that's the important point. And furthermore, it's going to be a tensor product of Pauli operators, okay? So you essentially get the physics of the toric code, and then from this you can repeat the story and show that you have something which is thermally unstable, okay? Yes?
With 2D topological stabilizer code, this means each of the stabilizers is nearest neighbor, local than the 2D lattice, or what's...
Okay, the fact that it's 2D, yeah. So we're assuming that the generators are going to be local terms that act on a few particles that are close by.
Or any constant number of particles.
Any constant, yeah. But it cannot scale with system size. Okay, so essentially, so with this result, we rule out all 2D stabilizer code. So maybe you could think, well, let's go beyond 2D. Can we do something by extending and going to a more general Hamiltonian? So let's look at a Hamilton of this form. So you have a 2D lattice, and you have qubits on it, and you're going to have a bunch of local terms. The local terms are going to have bounded strength, so I'm not cheating by putting an extra amount of energy into one term and having it scale like system size. I'm just, all of them are going to have some constant amount of norm. I'm going to take the case where the terms commute, okay? This is essentially going to make my life easier, and also you can make a story where if you have a Hamiltonian where the terms do not commute, you can map it to another Hamiltonian in the same topological phase where the terms commute. So I'm going to just look at the case where they commute. Terms are going to be local, exactly in the sense that Thomas pointed out, that the local terms can only act on a small number, on a constant number of particles that are close to one another. And I'm going to look at frustration-free system, meaning that a ground state of the global Hamiltonian is going to be a ground state of each of the individual local terms. Moreover, since I'm only interested in the ground space of the Hamiltonian and the scaling of the energy gap, I'm going to restrict all those local terms to be projectors. Okay? So I'm going to end up with this class of local community projector codes. So you have a set of elementary projectors. They commute with one another. And a ground state is going to be a plus one eigenstate of each of those. Okay? So one picture that you can have in mind is this lattice where each point would correspond to qubit, and each circle corresponds to the support of one of those elementary projectors. Okay? And they define my topological system. You can convince yourself that stabilizer code fit into this template of local commuting projector codes. But more generally, local commuting projector codes can have nothing to do with Pauli operators. They could just have arbitrary commuting projectors. And most topologically ordered systems fit in that framework. So the toric code, quantum doubles model fit in there. Color codes also, Levin-Wien string models, Trevor codes, they all fit in that very broad framework. And what's something that's really nice about this class of codes is that we have a criterion for spectral stability. So that's a result from Bravi, Hastings, and Michalakis. So under this mathematical condition called local topological quantum order, you can prove that the spectrum of those systems is stable. So local topological, yes?
Sorry, you
can
say again what you mean by stable for the spectrum?
Okay, so well, I'm going to have, but essentially you have a gap system. You don't want the gap to close.
Yeah.
And you don't want the degeneracy of the ground state to be lifted by the perturbation.
So what kind of errors do you allow?
You will allow something that's exponentially small in system size.
But you said you don't want the gap to close. You don't want the gap to close when you do what?
When you add a small local perturbation to the Hamiltonian.
Okay, any small local?
Local. The key term is local.
And so small is norm scale, like what?
Small is that, so suppose you have, you're going to put, I'm going to actually talk about that, but
okay, wait,
you have a sum of terms. Each of those terms is going to have norm one. And you're going to put an epsilon in front of it, and you want this epsilon to, well, up to a constant to not close the gap. Okay, so local topological quantum order. Well, first, when you have a topological phase, typically, well, you don't want the local operators to be able to discriminate between ground state. Okay, this is the thing we have in the back of our minds when you talk about a topological system. One way to phrase it is this Neil-Laflamme condition for any local observable that acts on a small topologically trivial region A. P here is the projector onto the code space. Actually, this is not enough. You need a second condition called local consistency, which more or less says that local ground states are compatible with the global ground space. And so when you take those two assumptions, you can prove that the spectrum is local. So what do I mean by stable spectrum? So I'm looking at this Hamiltonian, which is originally a sum of local commuting projectors. And I'm going to put a perturbation of this form. This is a sum of local terms. Each of them is going to have norm one, and there's some coefficient j in front of it. So initially, I have this type of spectrum. I have the ground space. I have the first excited states. I have a constant gap between the two. And now I'm going to put some arbitrary local perturbation. And I want to know how the spectrum is going to change with the strength of the perturbation j. So first, you could think, well, there's a gap. If j is small enough, then there's no way I'm going to close the gap. So just be careful that if you just look at this the sum here without the j, just the sum, the norm of it is going to scale with the system size in general. Okay? So even with a small j, something like it's the same 2D that will go as 1 over L square, there's enough energy in the perturbation to actually close the gap. Okay? So it's not just having a gap that protects the system, it's really the topology and the fact that you're looking at local perturbation. And so what you can prove, since we don't know the exact form of the perturbation, we don't know for sure where the energy, let's say the first excited state, is going to be, but it's going to be somewhere inside this crescent. Okay? And furthermore, there's going to be some exponentially small fuzziness to the energy level. But what's important is that for some finite j, you're not going to close the gap. Okay? The gap is going to remain. And furthermore, the degeneracy here is only exponentially lifted by something exponentially small in system size. So in the limit where you have a very large system, this doesn't matter so much. Okay? So this is what I mean technically by a stable spectrum. Okay, so we're looking at 2D local commuting projector codes. We're going to look at a subset of them that obey this LTQ condition so that we ensure spectral stability. And we want to know if we can find one that can be used as a self-correcting memory. And unfortunately, we're again going to see that there's a no-go theorem for that. So that's something I work on during my PhD. So we started from what was known in the literature. What was known in the literature is that for those 2D local commuting projector codes, logical operators are supported on a 1D strip, as in the case of 2D stabilizers. However, in general, they're not going to be a tensor product. Okay, so we'd lose that key feature that we needed to prove instability in case of stabilizer. So you have this 1D strip that supports a logical operator. And the intuition is that in those systems, excitations are point-like, and they do propagate without energy cost. So what the environment could do to destroy the information would be to create out of the vacuum, out of a ground state, a pair of point-like excitation, move one around the torus, bring it back to its original partner, fuse them back to the vacuum, so return to a ground state. And then the environment, without paying too much energy, took you from one ground state to a different ground state. Okay? So this is the intuition that we have that was true in the case of the Turing code, but in general is true for any 2D topological system. Problem is that we cannot prove the existence of those quasar particles just from looking at the microscopic topological Hamiltonian. Okay? Nobody knows how to do that, although it's true for all the examples we know of. So the situation was the following. We started from the 2D topological Hamiltonian to ensure spectral stability. We knew that if there were some quasi-particle freely propagating in the system, then the energy barrier would be independent of system size, meaning that I do not have a self-correcting system. So the simple strategy is to say, well, let's try to prove, starting from 2D topological Hamiltonian, that we have those quasi-particles. Okay? But this turns out to be very difficult to do. And in the end, what we did was to bypass that step and directly prove from the Hamiltonian that you have an energy barrier independent of system size, therefore showing that you have a non-self-correcting system.
So the vertical arrow on the left is unknown?
Unknown at the moment, yeah. We'll actually work on that, but we don't have a definite answer for that. There's some progress, but there's no clear-cut answer. My guess would be that it is true. So the way we proved that result was using a stochastic approach. So we considered the following scenario. So we knew that there was a strip where the logical operators supported. So what we did is imagine a case where the environment would apply a random unitary transformation, okay, creating two puddles of energy. And then what the environment would do is it would take an arbitrary random transformation, say according to the R measure, would apply it on one excitation, try to move it. Most cases, it doesn't work. But then you can actually prove that there always exists a transformation that will work. And then the environment would just check the amount of energy locally to not to create too much energy. And we do that sequentially. And by doing that, trying local transformation until it finds ones that works, it would move this puddle of energy around the 1D strip, bring it back to its original partner, and go back to the vacuum. Okay? And the environment can do that, and that costs only a small amount of energy independent of system size, proving that there's no energy barrier. Okay. So now we have this result. So what do we do? Essentially, we know that in 2D, for a very general class of Hamiltonian, we will not get an energy barrier. Well, so first, one thing we could change the definition of, well, we could change the problem, okay? So instead of looking at self-correction, we could just say, well, let's go to active error correction. And indeed, you get threshold, but it's kind of cheating, you're changing the problem. This is a result about 2D, so let's go to higher dimension. So what can you do in 4D? You actually get something self-correcting, but that's not very experimentally friendly. What can you do in 3D? Or you can also imagine having a 2D system where by coupling it to a 3D model, you introduce long-range interaction. Okay, so that's three possibilities. And maybe looking at the energy bar is not the right way to think about the problem, or maybe there's some other ways to protect the quantum information. And you could also think about something that is based on entropy. Okay, so in the rest of the talk, I'm going to look briefly at those 5 points and tell you what's the current status about each of those. So any questions at that point? Maybe that's also a good one. Yes?
How much do we know about the non-commuting phase?
Not much. Okay. So again, you can make that story that if you're in topological phase, if you look at the precise Hamiltonian that is in general non-commuting term, you should be able to bring it to another Hamiltonian in the same topological phase which has commuting terms. And then maybe there's a way to, well, apply this no-go result for the commuting Hamiltonian and bring it back to the non-commuting original Hamiltonian you're interested in. That's not totally worked out. So yeah, there's a lot of things to understand better.
But like, so there are heuristic reasons why there should be a no-go theorem for?
Yes, in 2D, yes.
Okay.
But again, it's not proved.
Yeah.
Okay, so active error correction. Okay, so we're changing the problem. We're not looking at the hard drive anymore. We're looking at some kind of RAM. So if we go back to the template, we're precisely going to allow to do what I said was not allowed in self-correction. We're going to, on a short time scale, do measurements, try to diagnose the error, and actually do something to correct the error. So if you do that, we have threshold theorems saying that if the noise level is low enough, you essentially can do perfect decoding and keep the quantum information alive for a very long period of time. Okay, so that's true, for instance, in the case of the Toric code. So if you have low noise level, then you can decode perfectly and keep the information. So this is nice, this is a different problem, but I mean, this is some nice solution to keep quantum information, and actually experimentalists are looking at this, not on a torus, because building a torus experimentally is kind of hard, but on a 2D flat version of it, which are surface codes. So there's a strong experimental effort from teams in IBM, UCSB, and other places where they're looking at this problem. And you have papers about experimentalist-friendly version of those codes. But again, this is not self-correction, so this is not really the question we're asking in this talk. So let's go back to self-correction. We have a noble result in 2D. What can we do in higher dimension? So let's look at 4D. And so one idea will be to say, well, I have a 2D model, toric code, with active error correction, I can correct it and keep the information, quantum information alive for a very long period of time. Is there any way for me to embed this active error correction, the active quantum error correction, inside the Hamiltonian and have the system do it for me? So the problem is that some steps are not classical, are not local in the quantum error correction, namely, for instance, the post-processing, when you look at all the syndromes or all the, well, syndromes coming from all, let's say, the plaquettes from the Toric code, to something non-local. But you can make it local in 4D. Okay. So you can embed those 2D non-local things into a local 4D interaction. And then you define this 4D Toric code, which has a 6-body interaction. And you can prove that there's a phase transition at non-zero temperature. Okay, meaning that at low temperature, you're in the ordered phase. And as long as you're not you don't cross this threshold temperature, you're going to remain in the ordered phase. And it's only after this threshold temperature that you get to a disordered phase where you lose the information. Okay. So this is a very strong criterion for self-correction. And so this system is about the only system we have in mind, well, the only example we have for self-correcting system. Okay, but this is 4D. And this is not experimentally friendly. Maybe there's some way to revert the process and embed those local 4D interactions in smaller dimension. Okay? So later in the talk, I'm going to talk about the case where I'm going to effectively introduce long-range interaction in 2D. So this is going to be somehow related to this idea. Okay? So 4D, it works. But I mean, this is not practical to build such a quantum error. All right. So while we looked at 2D, okay, we had string-like logical operators, we had point-like excitation. We look at 4D. In 4D, you don't get any point-like excitation, and you have something self-correcting. So we look at the 2D toric code, 4D toric code. We're going to look at a 3D toric. 3D toric code, again, you get point-like excitations, so you don't get something which is thermally stable. And actually, you have noble result in 3D. So Bini issued a proof that if you have a local translation invariant, scale invariant stabilizer code, you're going to have point-like excitation, and then you have thermal instability. So this scale invariance, that means that the digits of the ground space does not change as you change the system size. Okay, so that's a pretty natural assumption. However, Zhang Waha came up with an example, the cubic code, which does not satisfy that hypothesis. And that's a simple, well, that's a stabilizer code, which has this form. You have an eight-body interaction. And you can look at this thing to check whether you have self-correction. And one interesting feature of this model is that you don't get string-like logical operators. Okay, the logical operators are going to be fractals. Related to this, you're going to get an energy barrier that grows logarithmically like with the system size. Okay, so it's not a polynomial, but at least it's growing. It's not a constant. So maybe you can get some self-correction there. And that's due to the fractal logical operator. So numerically, we looked at the self-correcting properties of this cubic code. And so here, that's a plot of numerical simulation of the memory time in terms of the linear system size. Okay, and so you see that the memory time increases exponentially until it reaches some threshold, and then it either plateaus or actually goes down. So memory time grows exponentially with system size, as long as you're below some critical size that you can actually estimate. So if you optimize at a given temperature the size of the memory, you get the scaling of this one, okay, where beta square is just physics learning language for the inverse temperature, so 1/10 temperature. So this is a nice scaling in terms of temperature. However, this is still a constant independent of system size. Okay. So this is not what we're after, but this is still nice. So since then, we've had other proposals in 3D. So welded codes have an even better energy barrier, but we don't think they are self-correcting. And you have fractal Spilnik winds and more exotic things. Okay, but yet, we don't have anything self-correcting in 3D. OK, so that was what happens in 3D. And we saw that in 3D, one of the reasons why the cubic code was at least partially self-correcting, gave us something, was due to the fact that we had fractal logical operators. Okay? So one crazy idea would be, is there any way to port that into 2D? So we have a theorem that tells us that logical operator or string-like are 1D. But maybe effectively, you could get some kind of some 3D fractal logical operator physics in 2D. There's actually an example of that. That's a model that was introduced by Benjamin Brown. So that's some, that's some code on QDITs. So those are generalized Paulis. And so I'm not going to go into the details of how it works, but essentially you have those defect lines in red. And whenever a local term, the Hamiltonian, sees a defect line, it's going to be modified in some non-crazy way. And now what can happen is that either you get a behavior where you create a pair of excitation out of the vacuum and they move along a line. So you get those string-like logical operators. But with higher probability, what's going to happen is that you start from two excitations. And whenever those excitations are going to cross a defect line, they have a tendency to split into a larger number of excitations. Okay, so for instance, two excitations. And then you do that repeatedly. Okay, so you have a word line of particle where they split into two parts again and again and again. And if you look at the word line that result from this, this is going to look like a fractal operator. Okay? So indeed, there's a 1D word line for quasi-particle, but most world lines are going to have this fractal structure. And if you look numerically at this example, what you get is essentially the same behavior as the cubic code. Okay, so effectively, you get the physics of fractal logical operator, even though there are logical operators present that are string-like, but they're not the most probable thing that's going to happen when you have excitation moving around. However, in this system, you get some partial self-correction. There's no energy barrier. Okay, so that kind of hints at the fact that maybe the energy barrier is not the right way to look at the problem. Okay, because remember that in the whole talk, we reduced the problem of self-correction to whether we add or not an energy barrier. And that's kind of cheating because we're looking at problems at non-zero temperature. And at non-zero temperature, a quantum system does not want to minimize its energy. It wants to minimize its free energy. And that's a trade-off between minimizing energy and maximizing entropy. Okay. And so already in the case of the Ising model, which I told you was self-correcting, I told you, well, there's an energy bar that scales up like as L. So according to the simple criterion, it should be self-correcting. But that's kind of cheating because if you're at non-zero temperature, there's a constant density of defect, the available energy is actually scaling like L square. So there's more than enough energy to actually overcome this energy barrier. However, you can prove that there's a phase transition because when you do a proper treatment of this entropy, you see that there are many more microscopic configurations which you have small spins flipping here and there than having a macroscopic error droplet appearing. Okay? And so that hints to the fact that maybe there's some way to protect codes by having entropy-related mechanisms. Yes?
Can you say again what you mean by a defect being more probable than another? Like, what's the, how do you estimate the?
Well, here they're essentially doing numerical simulations. And so imagine some kind of Monte Carlo procedure, and you're looking at how many configurations you have, or the excitation split compared to the configuration you have.
What's the process? How do we evolve?
How do they evolve?
Excitations, and then what's the evolution?
So here, they're looking at the open system approach that Evan Lambladian, it's called Davis map, that's very standard. And we think that reproduces as well.
Standard way of modeling the environment.
We're essentially modeling the environment. Well, we have an open system approach where the Lambladian, we think, is a good representation of what happens when you're in contact with a thermal environment. But we're not really modeling the environment more than that. But that's kind of a... That's already better than just looking at the energy bar. That's what they're doing. Okay, so maybe there's a way to look at entropy and to get a better criterion for self-correction than just the energy bar. Okay, so again, that there's some effort in the literature about that, but that's not really clear. All right, so just quickly, I wanted to tell you about this 2D models with long-range interaction. So the idea here is to say, well, we have thermal instability in 2D because you have point-like excitations that propagate no energy cost. That was the case of the toric code, but we think this is a good picture in general for 2D system. So an idea would be to try to introduce some long-range effective interaction between those quasar particles so that they don't have a tendency to go too far from one another. Okay, suppose you find a way to have them interact with one another, then they would stay close to one another, and they wouldn't create a logical error. So let's try to find an effective way to introduce this interaction. So this was the first example along those lines was the toric boson system. There's been other proposal. So I'm going to talk mainly about this last, more recent proposal. So here you have a 2D toric code of size L by L. And you're going to embed that into a 3D system. Okay? In this case, this is going to be bosonic. Bosons that interact with the and with the toric code. So there's some kind of interaction between the toric code and the boson system. And when you trace out the boson, you just look at the dynamics from the point of view of the 2D model, you get some effective Hamiltonian, and this effective Hamiltonian has attractive potential between anions. Okay? And so something we've looked at in this model is whether this is stable to perturbation or not. Okay? This is not a topological system. 2D system is. But now you're putting it into interaction with a larger 3D system, so the full Hamiltonian is not topological anymore. So we wanted to know whether or not it was stable to perturbation. Okay, so to go more into details, so you're going to take a model of the toric code which is slightly different than the one I presented before. So you're only going to get plaquette operators which are the form a sigma z sigma y sigma z sigma y. Okay, it's still going to be a four by the interaction. So that's going to be the WP terms. And on top of each plaquette, there's going to be one boson that interacts with it. And that's going to interact with the term A plus A dagger. Okay, so that's going to be the interaction term between the toric code and the boson. And there's going to be some Hamiltonian for the boson themselves. And that's going to be some on-site potential minus some hopping term between nearest neighbor I and J. Okay? So that defines some physical system. Actually, in that paper, they do add some fine-tuning condition that not really well, it's not really clear why it's there. And then when they look at this, they can show that effectively at the level of the toric code, when you trace out the bosonic system, you have this Hamiltonian where you have anions that effectively attract each other according to some one overall potential, so some gravitational-like potential. And now they can say, well, let's start from some ground state and let's see what's the amount of energy needed to create an anion, create an excitation out of a ground state. And you can convince yourself like that this is going to scale with the expectation value of this operator. Because creating an excitation in the ground in the toric code means that you're going to flip the eigenvalue of this term from being plus one to being minus one. So the amount of energy this is going to cost is going to scale with the expectation value of this term. And what they should be proven there in that paper is that the expectation value of this operator scales as L, scales as system size. Okay? So you get an energy barrier that scales with system size, and because of that, you get some kind of self-correction. Okay? So this is what happened for the precise Hamiltonian. So we're trying to understand this better. So one thing you can do to understand this Hamiltonian better, so you have some lattice model. You can map it to some QFT, so quantum field theory, which is going to have this form. So you're going to have some gradient energy, and you're going to have some source terms W that's going to be coupled linearly to some scalar field phi. Okay? And the mapping between those things is simply to promote this bosonic operator that appears in the coupling to be a scalar field. Okay? What I claim is that those two things are equivalent. So to prove equivalence, it's called, just for convenience, this thing sigma p, theta p. And then you can write the gradient in this form. Okay, you're going to look at the nearest neighbor of p and take the difference of them. You can compute this term. And what you get exactly is 6 times this on-site potential minus a hopping term between nearest neighbor. Okay, and this is precisely this fine-tuning condition that we had initially in the lattice model, that the on-site potential has to be 6 times the hopping term. And now once you do that, when you've proven the equivalence of those two models, you can redo all the calculation that were done in the original Pedrocchi paper with this picture. You can look at the Thiele equation. It's a Poisson equation with a source term. You can compute what's the energy to add a quasi-particle. You find, again, that it's going to be something that scales with the linear size of the toric code. So you recover all the result of the Pedrocchi paper. So just to give you some kind of intuition, what happens in this model is that if you look at the scalar field phi, it's going to be equal to 0 at infinity. But where it sees the toric code, its ground state is to have a value minus L. Okay, so that's the configuration when the toric code is in its ground state. And when there's a plaquette that changes term, that's going to correspond to having a source term here. That's going to, the field is going to react by trying to to raise its energy. And there's going to be a huge gradient energy due to that. Okay, and this energy that you have to put in the system to change the configuration of the field is going to scale like system size. Okay, so that's another way to see the energy bar. Okay, so now we have a new way to describe the system. Now what you want to know is what happens when you put a perturbation. So in terms of field theory, one possible perturbation is to put a phi square term here. That's going to give a mass to the boson that were initially massless. And now this long-range interaction is going to become short-range. Okay, and now we have a short-range physics. We have the usual picture of 2D topological system, So we can prove that the energy bar is a constant independent of system size. In terms of lattice model, this terms will correspond to putting some perturbation to the on-site potential, to the term A dagger A. And essentially what that tells you is that you don't want the A plus A dagger terms to be too highly occupied, okay? You put some penalty to having it too largely occupied, and by doing this, you're introducing an effective cutoff, okay? So you can turn this kind of picture to a more general argument by looking at the ways a topological system can couple to phonon, photons, any time of gauge bosons. And you can prove that in general, there's always going to be a perturbation that's going to make it so that the energy barrier, if it was scaling with system size for a precise Hamiltonian, you're going to find a perturbation that's going to bring it down to a constant independent of system size, okay? It's a bit more difficult to port to the lattice model picture. However, for instance, for the case of the Petrarchy model, the model I told you about there, originally, you can prove that rigorously. So you take this term is going to be called theta. Theta is the thing that scales with system size that gives an energy barrier scaling with system size. And now you want to know what happens if I add a local perturbation to the Hamiltonian. So first thing that is very nice in this model and that actually allows you to prove everything is to realize that this theta operator commutes with the bosonic Hamiltonian. And that's precisely because of this fine-tuning condition. And then you're going to add a perturbation, which is a polynomial in theta. Okay, so usually the thing we have in mind is theta square or maybe theta to the 4. And now you can look at the way the expectation value changes with when you add a perturbation with epsilon strength. You can write down a differential equation where you have the variance that appears. And then you get something of this form. You have something, some exponentially small coefficient that depends on the way the variance scales with epsilon. So initially at epsilon equals 0, this is a constant. It's not, well, it's a complicated computation to actually see the way it scales with epsilon in general. So maybe this is not good enough to actually go from an energy barrier scaling with L to a constant, although I think it is. But then if you're not happy with this perturbation, just put a higher level perturbation like theta to the 4, then you can do the same work and you get something like this. And if you assume here that V was a constant, meaning that this is not good enough to kill the energy barrier, here, with a constant epsilon, you can show that this is going to go to a constant, independent of system size. Okay? So the take-home message of all this is that the energy bar is unstable under perturbation in those models. Okay? Maybe for a fine-tuned Hamiltonian, you get an energy barrier scaling with system size, but that's not going to remain true under perturbation. So to conclude, we've looked at canonical example of self-correcting memory. So classically, we look at a 2D Ising ferromagnetic model. This is not robust to perturbation, okay? So we said, well, this is due to the fact that we have a local order parameter that distinguishes between ground state. So in the quantum setup, let's look at topological model. We look at the toric code, which is the canonical example of a 2D topological model. It is thermally unstable. And then those ideas can be extended to a more general no-go result in 2D for stabilizer code or for even larger class of local commuting projector codes. So then what are the alternatives? We look at 3D, we have fractal spin liquid like the toric code, well, like the cubic code, where we get some fractal logical operators and some partial self-correction. In 2D, we argue that maybe looking at the energy bar is not the right criterion, so maybe there's some entropy effect to take into account. And so we don't have a good handle on this. And along the way, by doing all this work, we got new insight into the emergence of anions from microscopic Hamiltonian. So starting from this local commuting projector codes, can I actually prove that there's always an anion model correspond to low-lying excited states? Okay, so we have a better handle on this question, but we don't have a definite proof for that. But I think that's one example of something that is interesting to other branches of theoretical physics, mainly condensed matter, and that's interesting for them to have a more quantum information perspective on the question. And so therefore, that's an example of a contribution of quantum information to theoretical physics. And so with that, I'm going to thank you for your attention.
Further questions for you?
Yes.
So, I mean, for this idea of the 2D thing with long range interaction. Mm-hmm. You said it's underlying, it comes from a 3D model.
Yes.
But I mean, even before looking at the perturbations, well, I'm not, doesn't definitively say anything, but mm-hmm. presumably in order to be self-correcting when you reduce to 2D, it would also have to be self-correcting in 3D. Is that not a good intuition?
Does it have to be self-correcting in 3D? 2D? Well, you could imagine that you have some, think of the 3D system as some kind of ancillary system, so there might be something happening at that level. But if you look at the quantum information store initially in the 3D system, there's a way to retrieve. So it's not strict.
Sorry, I don't understand. I mean, the ability to retrieve it by looking at 2D, that's an extra property beyond just saying, oh, this is a 3D system.
Okay, so you're saying I encode, I prepare some state at the level of a 3D system.
Well, no, I'm saying let's look at one of these models that mm-hmm. people have proposed.
Yes.
Instead of thinking of it as a 2D model with
yes.
some extra stuff, let's
yes.
just think of it as a 3D model.
Yes.
So.
And your question is whether or not it has to be self-correcting already in a 3D case.
Well, I'm saying, is it possible that it could be self-correcting in the 2D case?
Yes,
without being self-correcting in the 3D case.
We don't have examples of that, but I mean, that's the idea between those proposals, is to say that this is not a full 3D system. The 3D system is only there to effectively introduce long-range interaction at the level of 2D.
Okay, but I still don't understand how you could hope to have it be self-correcting in the 2D case if it's not in the 3D case.
One example would be this fine-tuned Hamiltonian, where you don't, well, if you don't have any perturbation, well, okay, but it's not self-correcting because if you had a perturbation, but the idea would be that maybe there's something, you prepare some, let's say, tensor product state. Well, actually, no. You put some quantum information inside the toric code that you can going to retrieve by a syndrome, and the interaction with the 3D system is going to introduce long-range interaction. So maybe there's something, well, information is not preserved at the level of the 3D system, but that's not the information.
What does that mean? I mean, you can store the information wherever you want, right? It's not
yes.
even stored in a specific place, it's spread out.
Yes.
So if it's spread out in a 2D system, that's still, and it works, I mean, that's still good enough for a 3D system, right? I don't.
Yes, but you could imagine that there's no, well, I don't know, the image I might have in mind is some kind of subsystem code where you think of a 3D system of some gauge degree of freedom that something had happened to it, but we only care about the information in the 2D system. But maybe that's not fully convinced. But I don't see a reason a priori why we could not imagine having a 3D system which is not self-correcting and having part of it which is effectively self-correcting because it's all effective on that.
But I mean, what advantage does the smaller system have that the bigger system doesn't have that lets it be self-correcting? I mean, does the environment not affect the 3D system? Presumably it should, right?
Okay, so you're saying that if I have a 2D effective self-correcting system, I have a 3D system which is self-correcting where I put, well.
That's what I would think, yeah.
Oh. Yeah. I don't think there's, if you do put a constraint on like the way the environment couples to the 3D and 2D system, then there would be a distinction between the two. But
yeah,
if
but
you
I don't
see
why there could be such a constraint.
Yeah, I agree. I thought, well, yeah. No.
Okay, anything else?
Yes.
Is having periodic boundary conditions a necessary condition for self-correcting code?
I wouldn't say it's a criterion in general, but I mean, so for instance, if you look at toric code, if you don't put periodic boundary condition, just for the toric code, you put it in a sphere, you don't get the degeneracy of the code space.
Yeah, I mean, so how feasible would any of these be realistically if you have to make a physical system
somewhere? Okay, so the thing look, people are looking at when they look at something which is like the toric code is actually surface codes.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially the idea is that you take a 2D lattice of qubits, you punch a hole, that's going to create some topological degeneracy because you are going to have logical operators that wrap around this hole. And then you get the same kind of physics without having to actually impose periodic boundary condition and creating a crazy torus in your lab. So yeah, you don't have to have this.
Okay. What would the analogy for that be for, say, a 2 or 3 dimensional one?
To a 3D topological system?
A 3D or 4D one.
Would that correspond to?
Yeah.
So for instance, the cubic code I defined was just some 8-body interaction on the cube.
Yeah.
So
is there like an unwrapping like you just mentioned for punching a hole in a surface code?
There's no published work on this, but you can actually punch holes in it, and there's a variant of cubic code for which you can punch the holes and you can show that there's a certain amount of distance, the logical operators, stuff like that.
Okay.
Okay, if there are no further questions, thank Olivia again. Okay.